Hello, everybody. Welcome to News for the Soul. This is Daniel Brinkley.
This is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
Okay, everybody, take a deep breath. We know that we choose to come to this world, and we're chosen to come to this world, and we've come for breath. We breathe in for ourselves and out for spiritual unfoldment. And as we breathe these moments, let's open up our heart and open up our souls, and let the true awareness of News for the Soul make its impact now and forever.
Good afternoon, good evening, wherever and whenever you're listening. I'm Nicole Whitney, and this is News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. It is Monday, February. What is the date today? 5th. My God. February the 5th, 2007 already. And we have a new guest to introduce you to today, someone I've been looking forward to talking to for some time. Daniel Pinchback is with me for this full hour. He is the author of Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism. So you know we're going to be talking about ayahuasca at some point in there. Popular subject on News for the Soul. Also, his new book is now out, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. Hopefully I said that right. Let's welcome him on and start the fun. Daniel Pinchback, welcome to News for the Soul.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Muchly appreciated. And you've been up to some interesting work in the past years. Now, I understand you used to be pretty mainstream New York Times, Harper's Bazaar, that kind of stuff, as far as your journalism and writing.
Yeah, I was sort of both counterculture and mainstream. My mother had been part of the Beat Generation. She was a writer. She wrote a book called Minor Characters that was about her involvement with Jack Kerouac and the Beats in the 50s.
Oh.
But I was also, you know, I edited a literary magazine in New York, and I wrote for the New York Times Magazine and Esquire and Wired and all sorts of magazines like that.
And then at some point, you went purely metaphysical?
Well,
started
yeah.
a journey?
I mean, what happened is that I hit a massive spiritual crisis in my late 20s, I'd grown up, very atheistic without any kind of background in spiritual ideas, really, sort of a Freudian, secular scientific culture in New York. And I just sort of hit the wall in terms of that whole value system and also, you know, what it seemed to be doing to people and the planet and so on. So I went back through my sort of early life and tried to see if there'd been any other kind of indications of anything else, and remembered my psychedelic experiences in college as being the most significant signs that there were other forms of consciousness or some kind of deeper potential. So I had all these journalistic tools, so I began to explore that subject as a journalist. I went down to West Africa and went through a tribal initiation in Gabon, taking Iboga, which is a visionary plant they use down there, a psychedelic plant, And I also went down to the Amazon and visited the Sequoia Indians, worked with ayahuasca, and visited Oaxaca, the Mazatec Indians, and worked with mushrooms. Then I also wrote about sort of the evolution of psychedelic culture over the 20th century, different modernist intellectuals who'd done this kind of exploration. And then I also visited the Burning Man Festival and wrote about sort of LSD in the 60s and synthetic compounds and so on.
Okay, so all in the quest for finding out what the truth really was about our consciousness, our existence. What was your main question going into all of that?
Well, my initial question was, is this it? You know, is the kind of tangible material reality and the kind of scientific worldview, you know, is that the all that we can experience and all that there is? And once I began to recognize that that wasn't the case, because I began to have these experiences of, spirit world experiences and a lot of synchronistic experiences and telepathic dream world experiences, then the sort of question became, you know, why had the modern Western world sort of suppressed and repressed this other form of consciousness and this other way of knowing and thinking? And, you know, why had we, you know, exterminated the witches in the Middle Ages? Why had we, you know, annihilated all these shamanic cultures? Why did we, you know, suppress and outlaw and ridicule these psychedelic substances that were the kind of sacred, medicines of a lot of these tribal cultures around the world?
And why are we conditioned to poo-poo on any idea that suggests, even remotely, that we're more than the physical? Hmm?
Yeah, well, I mean, so that became my big quest and, you know, sort of ran over both books. But, I would say that and the way I really look at it is that it's like an evolutionary process. And if you look at, you know, tribal societies or mythical societies, there's a kind of immersion in this kind of magical consciousness and this kind of participatory mode. And in order to sort of emerge out of that, to develop individuality and technology, which I think are sort of aspects of human evolution, we had to go through a temporary process of being alienated from nature and one another and kind of lose touch with any kind of higher faculties. And I think that evolutionary process has now is completing itself. And what I argue in my new book, 2012, is that what we're really moving into is a new form of human consciousness where we reintegrate the sort of shamanic and mystical modes of cognition with the rational, empirical way of knowing.
Well, you know, I can tell you over the years, several of them, that I've interviewed people across the board from science to metaphysician to anything in the middle, everyone is saying that. Everyone is having an inner knowing or sense of just that. So I'm curious, though, I'd love to, before we kind of get into that, is get a few more details about sort of what your experience was on the way to this revelation and this, you know, you mentioned you had telepathic experiences and such and your own inner knowing. Like, what did you actually, you know, a couple of specific examples of what you experienced along the way that made you really go, I know that we're more.
I mean, if you consulted my friends from high school and college and so on, I was always a pretty skeptical person. So it takes quite a lot to sort of convince me of something. But I'm also, you know, I guess I'm also fairly open to possibilities. But, you know, it really started with the, early experiences with visions I had with ayahuasca. I remember the first time I took ayahuasca, which was in this ceremony downtown, I had this sort of awareness of this kind of healing intelligence that was kind of scanning my body and sort of looking at all of my systems and then purifying and getting rid of junk and stuff that I didn't need or shouldn't be holding. And then when I was down in Africa, when I took Iboga, I went through this whole, Iboga is a very long psychedelic, it lasts like 15 hours or something. I went through this long journey through my past experiences, childhood experiences, and it really felt like once again there was this kind of guiding intelligence in the plant medicine that was showing me, revealing sort of particular aspects of my, of how I've been sort of constructed as a person. in order so I could sort of see them more clearly and grow out of destructive patterns and so on. And then there were also, you know, some sort of particular little hints, telepathic. I mean, sort of like there was at one point I saw these letters spell out this phrase, touchers teach too, and later, you know, a couple of years later I sort of understood the significance of that phrase for me. The guide who brought me down there, he told me that when he'd been shown that he wasn't going to live very long, when he went through his Iboga initiation, and then he died maybe a year and a half or 2 years later in a sort of freak car accident in South Africa. The shaman who took Iboga with when I didn't take it another night said that he saw the spirit of my mother's mother hovering around me, and she had just recently died, and he had no way to know that. And he just seemed to know things about her and our relationship that were you know, I hadn't told him, that he was just beaming into. So, yeah, I just began to recognize that, you know, there was the potential for this intuitive knowledge and mystical perception. And then I just began to have a huge experience of synchronicities and all sorts of stuff. I mean, I document it and detail it in depth in the two books.
So literally an awakening in your own experience, direct experience with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned having a guide and having plant medicine, which is probably a good point to make the distinction at this point, because every time I talk about ayahuasca on a show, I get tons of email, where can I buy it? You don't just go to a store and buy it, right? You have to have some kind of ceremonial process around this and do it properly in a proper place.
To be honest, I actually have bought it. I mean, you can buy the plant material through various sites on the internet, I think. I mean, the sort of legality of this keeps changing. But I think that the plant material, and there's also ayahuasca analogs, so you can actually buy this plant material and follow a certain recipe and boil it up in your house. I don't think it's, you know... I mean, I think owning the plant material is one thing, and then actually making ayahuasca is dubious in terms of legality. But there is, there are ceremonies. And one thing that's happened right now is the Supreme Court recently decided that this Brazilian church, Unão de Vegetalis, could continue to use ayahuasca as its sacrament in the United States. So that's a pretty interesting development. And there's another church that I've worked with called Santo Daime. And the hope is that the same ruling will apply to the Daime. There's really no reason that it shouldn't. So there may actually be a more sort of legal access to having these kind of experiences in the future.
Oh.
Much the way the Native American Church has some legal protection.
Okay. So let me rephrase it in another way. Anyway, as far as the process and sort of the, like, it's not like you're not talking about the equivalent going and getting hallucinogenics on street drugs and, you know, for the purpose of just removing yourself from reality. You're talking about a sort of a different approach, more conscious approach. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I suppose, the language that you just used for me was very biased language, and you know, yes, legally we're not supposed to take hallucinogenics, but I feel there's so much kind of language has been kind of evolved, which to me doesn't necessarily correspond to a lot of people's experience. I mean, when I got back into psychedelics myself, the first thing that I was, you know, did was, you know, went and explored mushrooms and LSD again, and I didn't have a sacred context for them, yet for me they were very profound opening experiences, and same in college when I took mushrooms, and, you know, so... I just think psychedelics as a class of substances are very, very different than narcotics, you know, or stimulants.
Okay.
You know. Yeah.
Well, we're getting an education today. So. now, I guess what I would say.
I also want to say that I'm not actually I don't see myself as an advocate of psychedelics. Like, I've been called, you know, like, I'm advocating them. And actually, I don't necessarily advocate them, but I do think that, you know, what I do in my books is do my best to express the importance that these experiences had for me. And then I really think it's up to the individual to make their own decision, you know.
Okay. Well, let's talk more about what you experienced as far as you came away with feelings of the bigger picture of what was going on with the our true nature, our true reality. How would you sum that up?
Well, I mean, it's a lot to sum up, right? I mean, it took me a lot of pages. But, I mean, there are, you know, experiences that I've had, you know, using substances and then also not using substances, which have convinced me that sort of consciousness is the underlying, you know, kind of drama, you know, that we're in this drama of the evolution of consciousness. And, you know, that is really what interests me. I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, there's a substance called dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, which is a component in the ayahuasca potion. You can also, you know, it's also in our bodies. It's in our spinal cord, in our brains. There's an interesting book called DMT, The Spirit Molecule, where this guy studied it and had the opportunity to research it in New Mexico. And when you smoke it or inject it, you are plummeted into or shot into an altered dimension, which seems very, very highly developed, sort of hyper-organic, futuristic, extra-dimensional. And it really almost feels like there's a higher level of consciousness taking place in wherever that dimension is, and that somehow we are enmeshed with these other levels of consciousness that are going on in the cosmos.
So, is there any consistency to the visions that you were having in these different experiences?
There's a lot of consistency. I mean, within the different substances, it's almost like, I mean, I sort of ended up seeing these different substances as almost like they sort of reveal like different bandwidths or frequencies of consciousness.
So it was in a different realm, a different dimension or something real to you?
Yeah, I mean, not just to me. I mean, a lot of people have this experience. I mean, and people have sort of seemed to be mapped on the different aspects of the experience. I mean, Terence McKenna talked about, you know, kind of encountering the machine elves of hyperspace. And I never exactly encountered the machine elves of hyperspace on DMT, although I have seen elvish sort of creatures on ayahuasca and on mushrooms.
Elvish,
yeah.
Elvish. Oh, my goodness. Big difference there. Well, that's why I was asking, though, because if there seems to be a real consistency to certain kinds of beings that people report being at least in ayahuasca and interacting. Did you interact with beings?
Yeah, I mean, beings or cosmic intelligences, or archetypal phenomena, you know, I suppose, yeah.
And the healing that you mentioned, that was another common report back from many people that had this experience, it seems. Did you actually physically have something healed?
No, not exactly. But I mean, I would say that I subscribe to the hypothesis that ayahuasca has incredible healing powers. You know, on different levels, subtle levels and physical levels. But part of my experience with iboga was the first time was seeing the pattern of using alcohol in my life, and you know, it wasn't like I stopped drinking right after, but I sort of recognized the sort of negative effect that alcohol had on me on a lot of levels, and made a kind of permanent reduction in alcohol consumption. And in fact, iboga or ibogaine has been studied and is being used in a lot of substance abuse and addiction treatments.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you next, is how has your own life changed, you know, since you embarked on this journey?
It's changed in many ways. You know, on many levels. I mean, I think, first of all, just like my inner life is entirely transformed. I mean, you know, basically, the trajectory that I've been on was, you know, once I recognized that this shamanic reality existed, and that our modern Western culture had kind of unfortunately negated this other way of knowing, then I became concerned about what kind of effects that loss of this knowledge system could be having on our society, and I began to recognize that a lot of these indigenous cultures are holding what they believe to be kind of prophetic knowledge about the time that we're in now, and that sort of the most developed version of this prophetic knowledge seems to be, you know, from Mesoamerica, and especially the Mayans who were you know, tremendous experts in astrology and astronomy, and have made these precise calendar calculations. So, you know, I went from having reintegrated this shamanic and psychedelic vision to recognizing that we're in this time of intense transformation, and really trying to really figure out how I could be best of service to this transformational process.
So I guess that being the title of your second book, I guess that is the focus of that book, is it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, if the sort of like, I guess what I do is I write books in terms of the questions that come up in my mind. And so the first book question is, you know, is there a spiritual dimension of being? And if so, you know, why have we negated it? And then the second book was, you know, having accepted that there is this spiritual dimension and the shamanic dimension, then, you know, what are these indigenous cultures? What is the importance of their knowledge system for us today?
So where did you begin with that? What is the significance of it today?
Well, I think that we are in a accelerated planetary process of transformation and consciousness evolution. And in a way, we have a kind of window of opportunity where we can either move into a much higher state of being, or we are probably not going to survive as a species. And I think the crux of this situation is actually the next few years.
Again, a sentiment that's echoed by many and validated through different sources, it would be the more conscious crowd. So evolved as beings, meaning what exactly?
Well, I mean, I think that what we're going to have to somehow, you know, accomplish is a kind of mutation in consciousness. Because at the moment you have, you know, this kind of American materialism or Western European materialism is now spread across the globe, and we're basically devouring the resources of the planet at this incredibly accelerated rate. And we're, you know, we sort of, our consciousness is centered on our own ego situation, our own personal ambitions, our ambitions for our families, our desire for, like, good vacations and new houses and so on. And I think that is just going to be swept away. And what's going to have to replace it is a kind of awareness of the whole, and really how do we collaborate as a global community, almost a sort of planetary retribalization of humanity to create a sustainable planetary culture.
So what does your book suggest as far as what we can be doing to evolve in that direction?
Well, I mean, the second book, as I said, the thing was really recovering this indigenous knowledge system. My third book, which I just made a deal for, will be more focused on trying to figure out how we could create a model for a sustainable planetary culture in an accelerated time frame. However, you know, one thing that I mean, I guess in the second book, like, I see sort of the three main trends or factors are the you know, accelerated destruction of the biosphere, species extinction, climate change, etc. And the sense that, you know, we're really in this position now of, like, sort of like a car speeding towards a cliff where, you know, you keep hitting the accelerator, you know, rather than trying to brake, you know. And, you know, secondly, that we're having this accelerated evolution of technology. And I really see technology as a kind of aspect of humanity's psycho-spiritual evolution. So, you know, in a way, like, you know, any technology, any machine begins as a thought form, which then we turn into a material manifestation. So now we're creating technology that is a changing consciousness, I think. So, like, cell phones, social networks are actually shifting the nature of consciousness into a more collaborative framework and a more relational framework. We're kind of moving out of that sort of ego, alienation, individuation of the 19th and 20th century into a new framework of relational consciousness. Then the third aspect for me is the accelerated psycho-spiritual evolution, and especially, I would say, the psychic aspect, so that in my own life and in the lives of most people that I know, there's this incredible increase, acceleration of synchronicities, manifestations, and it almost feels that one's intention is becoming a more and more kind of palpable creator of possibility. And one way I look at it is it's almost as if the kind of boundary between the physical and the psychic is becoming sort of thinner and more permeable. It's like reality is becoming subtly less physically dense and more psychically responsive as we move towards this 2012 shift. So one thing that I think may happen is, one way I look at it, is that if you look at the Industrial Revolution in the 1750s, you know, before that time, you know, before or 1780s, or before that time, you know, people had no idea that you could use electricity to change the whole planet. You know, they just didn't know that you could take lightning, make it into a current, you know, and build a whole global industrial civilization. And once they understood that, we did it in this incredibly accelerated time frame of a century and a half. So it seems to me we might be on the cusp of a similar kind of realization about psychic energy and psychic capacity, paranormal capacity, and that actually we may actually be able to sort of pull that down into, as a transformative force for the human world as we enter this crisis in the next few years, or as we pass deeper into it.
So perhaps it's not that the veil is thinning at all, but we just didn't know what reality actually was.
Exactly. Or we were in a certain. There's this philosopher Gebser, who I talk about in my book, who talks about structures of consciousness. That we were in a certain structure of consciousness that was this kind of modern, rational, spatial consciousness, and we're now transitioning into a different structure of consciousness, which will have different, effects at every level.
Definitely, we're all agreeing to the fact that it's very interesting times that we're in right now. And speaking now, of course, to the News for the Soul audience around the world, you're preaching to the choir. So we're all on the same page, I think, as far as sensing that, like I said, we're evolving into something new and something important.
And I think one thing that's interesting is, like, sort of, the sort of new age of the last, 20 years, that kind of consciousness, a lot of its expressions were a little bit kind of sort of filmy or flimsy or ethereal. And now there's a more kind of sort of crystallization or hardening of our understanding, more definite. So for me, like, a lot of it is getting over our naivete about certain things. Like, the shaman was sort of turned into this heroic figure by the New Age. But actually, if you look at indigenous cultures, shamans tend to be pretty ambiguous. They're often at the outside of the tribe. They're sort of teepees or whatever in the other direction, and you're very careful about them because they can heal, but they can also kill or injure. So for us to reaccess the psychic realm means that we have to get over our kind of naivete and sort of really learn to make the distinction between kind of spiritual and psychic.
And also, if I guess maybe equivalent to the old thing of positive thinking only, as opposed to being in a higher conscious state, despite anything that's going on.
I think that, for me, there are things that to me are unfortunate. For instance, this whole in the kind of spiritual New Age culture, this whole focus on abundance. This laws of spiritual abundance and this idea that, if you intend to have material well-being, it's all going to come to you in this massive way. And, for me, I guess I have a more Jungian perspective, that there's this split between the ego and the self, and the desires of that higher self are not necessarily for, like, a new Porsche and a new house. The higher self that's trying to incarnate through the ego has much deeper and more profound kind of purposes. So I think we need to, move away from a certain kind of naivete, which has also been kind of like a salesmanship ploy for some of these people, like Chopra and so on,
I think that's also been a big shift as far as, it's not about stuff, but if you want to get out there and make a frigging difference on the planet, it's going to take bucks to, like myself, right? Single Mom starts a radio network, positive, uplifting information. I was a journalist as well before I started all of this as well and went on my own little metaphysical trip that's brought me here. But it takes bucks to put the show on the air and make, the stuff going. So I think you were right, that it's the purpose behind it that's more driving the new wave of, I never liked that New Age term, but, the more awake crowd isn't trying to get a Ferrari. They're trying to make an impact. and now on the planet, at least I would hope.
Yeah, well, I do think that in a way, like, in a transitional period, like having that Ferrari may almost be helpful because that's the value system of the culture. So if you're going to make an impact on the culture, you sort of have to use the value system of the culture and then kind of transmute it. You know, this is, I think, what Osho tried to do with his 99 Rolls Royces. He was kind of like mocking the materialism of the culture, you know.
99?
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
Getting back to your book here, I'm just reading the description of the serpent god. Can you explain what that is?
Quetzalcoatl. I hope that's the way to pronounce it. I'm not really sure. So Quetzalcoatl, plumed serpent, feathered serpent. He had sort of different manifestations in kind of Mesoamerican culture. There was a creator deity who's in the Popolva, and then there was a kind of mythical culture hero. Then there was a historical incarnation in the 10th century. And sort of, you know, represents a kind of a benevolent cultural presence. The historical incarnation sort of created a brief golden age and got rid of human sacrifices and so on. And what I see on a larger level as the idea of the feathered serpent, it sort of represents the meeting of the bird and the snake, which would be the meeting of air and earth, heaven and earth, spirit and matter. So it's the kind of integration of perceived opposites. And I would also say, once again, a kind of symbol of this integration of sort of intuitive, feminine, shamanic, cognitive modes with the rational, scientific, empirical way of thinking and knowing. And for me, it's really as those two sort of come together that we create this new form of consciousness.
So what specifically in your journeys with ayahuasca and different plant medicines, what specific messages did you uncover about this 2012?
Well, towards the end of 2012, there's the whole transmission that I received while I was working with the Daime in Brazil blew out my sockets for a while. I mean, it was basically where I was informed that I was sort of a vehicle or avatar for this Quetzalcoatl consciousness and information to sort of make a return to the planet. And it was a very interesting experience to go through because at first it was very like it was both humiliating and self-aggrandizing, and I would kind of like oscillate between those extremes. And luckily, I was sort of working with this woman teacher, shaman, who's also has a Jungian background and has also worked with archetypal material. And I really, began to understand the kind of the sort of Jungian model for working with archetypal material is that it sort of constellates in the psyche and it wants to almost like take over the psyche and it has to be kind of like tamed. And ultimately, the ego has to integrate the archetype rather than the archetype kind of overwhelming the ego. There's a Gospel of Thomas, Christ talks about, blessed is the man who eats the lion and the lion becomes man, and cursed is the man who's devoured, meets the lion and the lion devours him. And that could really be seen as being about this work to integrate archetypal material when it constellates in the psyche.
So, specifically, what did this message or this transmission say that you were to do?
Just do what I'm doing, I guess, kind of like write the book, talk about this stuff, it took me a long time to kind of develop the right, to regain my composure and kind of native skepticism about the experience. In a sense, it was like all these things that I'd been reading and collecting, thinking about, were kind of represented through this transmission in a more emphatic form, with some things I hadn't really thought about before. So it could be that, the ayahuasca just catalyzed this inner process for me. Or it could be that, while I was doing all that thinking and reading and cogitating, it was actually almost like a process of self-organizing that allowed this kind of higher consciousness to sort of touch down and integrate with me, you know. But basically, yeah, that we're in this apocalyptic process, and that people have to kind of do the work to, you know, kind of create the vehicle for their higher selves, and you know, there was a little bit of kind of reward and punishment in the message, that sort of people who, you know, have been doing the work for human freedom, for compassionate civilization, you know, are going to be in a better position as this transformation unfolds.
So apocalyptic in what manner?
Well, I mean, the way I look at apocalypse in the book is, you know, as the word apparently, you know, has the meaning of revealing or uncovering. So it's this time where there's more and more revealing happening and people's true natures become more and more apparent, you know. So I also really like Edinger's, who was one of Jung's students, the sort of definition of it as being the momentous event of the coming of the coming of the self, or the sort of integration of the ego in the self.
So, like lower self, higher self?
Yeah, I mean the ego, you know, which is our kind of locus of ordinary consciousness, with this, you know, these kind of archetypal energies, and you know, the sort of, you know, God image as the archetype of the self. There's a lot to, you know, I don't necessarily go into all this stuff all the time, except it's all in the book for people who want to delve deep.
So with respect to the true self being more evident and see-through-ish on people, would you say that's started already?
What's that?
Would you say that that has started already, where people's true nature is more apparent to others?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, once again, it's interesting how even the technology feeds into that, you know, because it's like basically nothing can be hidden so much anymore. You know, it's like if you try to get away with something, somebody will just, like, post it on, you know, MySpace or something, you know, and you know, and these kind of, you know, the Bush administration, for instance, you know, they're just, you know, there are these mountains of scandals that are like this, you know, it's like there's, you know, there's, all the information is out there and available, you know, the sort of hypocrisies, you know, are completely evident, you know.
What about in your visions and work with ayahuasca and the other plant medicines, did you ever have any visions of you know, the human race transcending the need to declare war on each other?
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily have visions about that on ayahuasca, but I think that for me, the transition we're going to make, you know, as we go into this next state of consciousness, is going to be into a pacified and peaceful planetary civilization. I mean, I really think humanity is done with this militarism and this war mania. I mean, I think it's really like a vestigial thing that's just like playing itself out now. And, you know, sort of very much like the Berlin Wall situation, there may just come a moment where, you know, the momentum, the sort of pendulum shift of consciousness is just made, and there's really, you know, it just becomes self-evident across the planet.
Hey, to me, something like that, in my honest-to-goodness consciousness, conscious mind, that seems inevitable. And so many people are speaking that way now, whereas, you know, 20 years ago, you probably wouldn't have heard that. So the overall vision and the closure of it that you have experienced on your quest here has been a positive outcome.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I would say yes, definitely. But, I mean, that also comes from, you know, understanding the sort of embeddedness of consciousness in what, you know, in what is and what is perceived, you know. So it's like when I interviewed Jose Arguelles, you know, who wrote all the stuff about the Mayan calendar, and, you know, he was the first one who was kind of giving me, and he had a very specific timetable. He was like, oh, you know, 2008 we'll start to take down the technosphere, you know, we'll go to telepathic seances, you know, we'll, you know, create peace. And I was like, Jose, this is ridiculous. This is never going to happen. You know, it's just like, how could you even say this? And he was like, look, you know, I'm a visionary, and my job as a visionary is to envision the best possible outcome for humanity. And I really sat with that for a long time. And I was like, you know what, that's like a great job. And, you know, I'm going to make that my job too. You know, and if everybody made that their job, you know, we could probably pull it off, you know. at the moment, you know, there's a lot of people who are still clinging to kind of fear and you know, anger, and are kind of in kind of lower vibrational modes of being. And, you know, that's, you know, going to play itself out somehow, you know, so we'll just have to wait and see.
What messages did you get specifically about those two issues, about transcending fear and anger in your life?
I don't know if I got messages about it. It's just been, you know, I think for me, it's, you know, it's just about the work one does on oneself, you know, to be able to more consistently, you know, stay in the kind of compassionate mode. And, you know, I mean, and it's great that life is this continual teaching on this stuff. You know, like, I mean, you know, I've definitely had a lot of experiences that, you know, were at least temporarily frustrating or embittering or angering, you know. And I mean, even over the summer, you know, I mean, I was, you know, proud of the whole book I put together. There was this Rolling Stone feature on it, also this New York Times Book Review, where they were just incredibly, I thought, sort of mean-spirited and didn't get it and made fun of me and stuff. And, you know, but it's like, you know, in a way, those were great, great opportunities, you know, for self growth, you know.
Opportunities. And, well, not to mention getting the word out about these experiences in some form in the mainstream, I guess, right?
Yeah, obviously. But, I mean, clearly, if, you know, if you got a New York Times reviewer who said, wow, everybody should think about this stuff, you know, you'd get the word out a lot faster than having to still deal with somebody who's basically an idiot.
What about God? Any encounters on the spiritual exploration?
Sure. I mean, you know, I just would, you know, I guess, you know, I don't see the, how do I say this? I ended up with the perspective that ultimately there's, you know, a kind of universal consciousness that we're all kind of fractal expressions of. And not just us, but also there are other levels of being and intelligence and super sensible consciousness and so on. So I would say the whole, you know, system would be that thing that we give the name God to, you know.
So that kind of metaphysical, we are God.
On our good days.
And then there's the other stuff. So what about the shadow stuff? Did it tell you anything about the shadow work?
Well, you keep, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I find myself a little bit resistant to the way you're kind of asking these questions somehow. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, yeah, I guess, you know, I showed myself, or that my psyche showed me, or it showed me, but, you know, all sorts of material came up. I mean, I had one, you know, I'd taken a synthetic psychedelic DPT, and I had a sort of negative occult experience where it seemed like this poltergeist had been unleashed, and there were various, you know, kind of all these dreams about this being, and poltergeist phenomena and stuff, and, you know, we kind of had to do this occult ceremony to sort of reintegrate this energy. So, you know, that was an experience I had. I didn't believe that such a thing was possible until I had that experience, you know. And, but it was, you know, in retrospect, great to have that experience. I mean, I learned so much.
So
you know, I think that, you know, that once again, to use the Jungian language, like integrating the shadow is absolutely what we're doing, trying to do. And if you kind of reject the shadow material or push it away or pretend it's not, you know, part of you, then you're going to just move it to another level of unconscious behavior, and it's going to re-manifest in a different form. So I try to keep my shadow, you know, in front of me these days.
The light's on. So I understand what you're saying. It's not like it showing you that it's a medicine for your consciousness to elevate.
Yeah, well, I just think we, you know, it's just language is really, you know, what did Flaubert say? Like, language is a cracked kettle drum in which we beat out tunes for bears to dance to or something. I mean, language is you know, this stuff is very nuanced and subtle, and, you know, I just get resistant sometimes to, you know, the formulations, you know, so, you know, but I've definitely had many profound experiences, you know, through shamanic traditions, and also, you know, dream experiences. You know, I mean, what's the it that's showing me something in a dream experience that's just as profound as a psychedelic experience? You know, I guess that it is my own psyche, right?
Right. Well, that makes sense. Rather than giving our power away to, you know, a substance outside of ourselves.
Right.
All right. Well, now, what is the best place that they can find you on the web to order your book?
Yeah, but I guess, you know, they can use the famous Amazon system. That's probably the best place, you know, or, you know, whatever. Or I guess there's that independent bookstore network. I don't even know if that's still going, but... yeah, so the books are there, and I also just started a column in the magazine called Conscious Choice, which is online, which is really exciting because it's, you know, both an online presence, and then there are four print publications, one in Seattle, which is Conscious Choice in Seattle, Common Ground in San Francisco, Whole Life Times in L.A., and Conscious Choice in Chicago. So that's going to be a fun place to, and I think the magazines are really good. There's, you know, these giveaway magazines that are about sort of spirituality and politics and ecology and so on.
Oh, they're very good magazines.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right, Breaking Open the Head and 2012, The Return of, here I go again, I'll try it, Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah, pretty good. Why not?
That's close enough. So if you get lost, just Google Daniel Pinchbeck and you will find them as you know I. And pick those up and read about the adventures, the shamanic adventures on consciousness and more.
Yeah, well, I think that the books are very useful as tools, kind of like you know, they sort of build foundations for people to understand these experiences and the whole situation, this transformative period that we're in. I mean, that's what I tried to offer.
Well, we've got 5 minutes to the top of the hour, and I know you haven't written book three yet, but this is the one piece that, if you can give us a little hint or clue, a couple little tidbits from that, because, you know, this is the overwhelming part, is that we go, oh, my God, we're in a major shift. Oh, my God, we've got to do something. Oh, my God, we've got climate change. You know, it's overwhelming, and everybody has the same question. Well, what do I do? As opposed to going into overwhelm or back into fear or going through a cycle, you know, anything that you can throw out there for the listener.
Yeah, well, I mean, well,
questions today.
What's that?
No small questions.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, we're clearly going to enter a different frame, and it may happen very quickly. I mean, you know, there might be a lot of coastal flooding, there may be a lot of environmental refugees, maybe millions of them. You know, the resource situation may get pretty dire. And, you know, it's going to be up to the individual whether that's like a cause for grief or cause for celebration, you know, and communion, you know. And for me, I mean, I think there are a lot of indications that it could be the second. I mean, even, you know, after 9/11 or when there was a blackout in New York, people came together. You know, there's something about this structure that we're in now, which is keeping people apart and alienated and mistrustful of each other. And, you know, when we go through this kind of transformational process, we're really going to need each other again, I think, you know. And I think we're going to have a lot to learn from indigenous cultures like the Hopi, who, you know, are subsistence agriculturists and really know how to survive on as little as possible. You know, our culture now is just based on a kind of ethos of total waste. You know, I mean, we could have green roofs on every roof in New York and Chicago and every other city. We could be growing, you know, gourmet mushrooms on, you know, every toxic waste dump. You know, I'm really interested in all these bioremediation practices. You know, like there's this guy Paul Stamets, who's a mycologist, and his work with mushrooms, or John Todd, who's working with creating living machines using algae and microorganisms and plants that can kind of filter out all the toxic stuff in wetlands and bodies of water. There's a lot of very profound pilot projects and thinking and visionary thought. It just needs to be kind of collected and presented properly. I think there's a lot of visionary work around economies, too. I mean, If we look at our economic system, you know, what is money? You know, since we've taken it off the gold standard, you know, what is the money? What is all that money really is at this point is this sort of collective belief in money as an exchange medium, and it might be that we could create a different kind of method of exchange. I mean, the indigenous cultures didn't even use money; they had ceremonial exchange, you know, or potlatches or something. So, you know, so it's just that we're going to really be challenged to think creatively. I think there's going to be a lot that we can gain from, you know, tribal cultures who had very sustainable life patterns for tens of thousands of years.
Excellent. So what's next for you as far as your next adventure or experience?
Well, I mean, this is the next adventure or experience is just trying to think through this stuff in a helpful way.
Us in the loop, Daniel, and I'd love to connect with you when your next book is out. When do you expect it to be out?
Well, I got to write it, unfortunately. Probably a year and a half,
Okay. Minimum.
Yeah.
And by then, who knows what we'll be going through on planet Earth? So, well, let's touch base then, and let's get you back on the show when you book out.
Okay. Thanks very much for having me. It was really fun.
Thanks for being here, Daniel Pinchback. You can Google him, find him online, and check out Amazon. The Quetzalcoatl. Oh my goodness, that's. I don't feel so bad because you actually weren't sure how to pronounce it either. So.
Well, I think it's Quetzalcoatl. It's Quetzalcoatl. I was told not to pronounce the last L.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Google Daniel Pinchback. You'll find it. And all the best, Daniel. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
All right. That's it for today, everybody. Tomorrow, go to newsforthesoul.com to hear the Mad Russian. We have Yefim Studentsov will be on. And we are talking about bioenergy, and he is actually joining us on the Lighten Up Literally episode this week, and our consciousness experiment in real-world results continues. So tune in tomorrow for that, newsforthesoul.com. If you miss any of this show or any of our shows anytime, newsforthesoul.com is where you go. They're all free all the time, so we can transcend and grow and evolve together. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'll see you next time.
This has been News for the Soul with Nicole Whitney. Visit us anytime online at www.newsforthesoul.com, where you can listen to all our previously aired shows at any time and so much more. Have a great week, and remember, what you focus on expands.